Hello and welcome to The Catbird Speaks. Up until very recently, the podcast for BP Southside, the local site for Baseball Prospectus covering the Chicago White Sox. However, some significant restructuring has meant that the BP Southside team has been folded into Baseball Prospectus at large. I am now notebook editor and bullpen editor Nick Schaefer, no longer co-editor-in-chief of BP Southside. But the exciting thing, well, many exciting things for the site with this change, and one of them has been much deeper integration with the BP team as a whole, which is great news because the BP team as a whole is fantastic. And along those lines, we have a special guest this evening who is from our R&D team over at the Mothership, but also was in attendance at the Guaranteed Rate Field meetup over the past summer. We have Anthony Reskin. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem. Happy to be here.
So you're Chicago area based. Are you primarily White Sox, but I think I've seen you doing some Cubs tweeting as well. I'm not sure if you wanted to.
Yeah, I just got to the point where I enjoy my time at both ballparks and, White Sox memes are a lot more fun than Cubs memes, and it's become kind of morally objectionable now, too, I think, to be a Cubs fan. Or at least it's becoming more and more morally objectionable than I'd feel comfortable with. So, I grew up on the South Side, East Side, precisely 110th and J. My family's been involved in the community down there since I was little and through now. I just enjoy Chicago baseball and having a good time, and, I'd say that's about my little snapshot of my baseball fandom.
Such that politics and baseball intersect. I guess you have this interesting, like, the Cubs have been much more successful on the field of late, but then, like, there's all this stuff about the Ricketts, which makes it feel like I don't envy a lot of Cubs fans sort of their moral choices. And I suppose you see you have that Addison Russell petition that was getting some coverage today about fans advocating for him to be kicked off the team. Because, the whole point of – ultimately, the point of being a baseball fan is to have fun. It's entertainment. It's supposed to be enjoyable. And, if you've got a player on your team who really, really brings you down for one reason or another, it would definitely make me reevaluate how I interact with the product, certainly. But in – happier news, less we won't go too far down that road. The hot stove is, I think it's like doing that thing where if you have a really finicky pilot light and it goes to start and you have to kind of like cajole it a couple of times, it's like, oh, you have to push in while you turn and it doesn't really go right away. I feel like that's where we're at, because stuff's happening, but the biggest piece is there's mostly been silence for the last few weeks. And I guess the current situation seems to be, I haven't heard anything about the White Sox on Harper in a few weeks, even though initially I thought he was their primary target. And now it seems like it's only the White Sox and Phillies in on Machado, and the White Sox seem to be going hard on Machado in their own fashion, and their best offer is somewhere in the $200 million range, years unknown, terms unknown, and Philly's offer we don't know, and the Yankees haven't made an offer. Is that what you've seen of late?
Yeah, I think that's the impression I kind of gotten. To me, it seems like the Yankees, for whatever reason, don't want to pay anyone anything, and that's open the door certainly for the Sox to really step in and fill that void. Honestly, at this point, if we're down to the Sox and the Phillies for Machado, I've gotten to the point where I don't really think there's any excuses for them not to win that battle. But at the same time, these things have a way of finding a bit of fluidity as they sort of reach the end point. It seems like we might have a little bit of clarity here, though, and the end of the tunnel might be nearing. But you never know with these things.
Yeah,
we already got to January, and I thought this was going to be done like a month ago.
Yeah, and I remember, I mean, I guess a month ago they had the meetings and then there was an announcement, Machado is going to decide after the new year. But, if having, doing a lot of negotiation myself in my professional life, I know there's this sort of bedrock principle that you never bid against yourself. So if the White Sox communicated an offer and Machado isn't budging off of his initial ask, the White Sox may not maybe reluctant to just up the offer, particularly without a competitive bid coming from Philly. Like maybe the White Sox and Philly are basically in the same spot and nobody wants to blink. So the White Sox are just piling up friends and relatives in the interim. But it there's a danger, I think, to stagnation. But I guess if the Yankees drop out, that's a good thing for the White Sox. But there's a, I mean, do you think it's possible that Machado signs like a 1 year, $30 million deal with like, gosh, I don't know, like the A's or something, some random team, to and because he's hoping that the Yankees and Dodgers will come to their senses next winter? Is that more likely than the White Sox upping their bid to say 250 or something that might actually get it done?
I don't necessarily think it would take them needing to bump it for him to sign. I think it's more or less it's just going to come to a breaking point on his end, which is unfortunate. I think I would view it personally if I was in Rick Hahn's seat, and view this something like when a team makes a move for a impending free agent at this time of year. Like the Cardinals did, they don't necessarily have an agreement in place for Paul Goldschmidt, but they feel confident that they could sign him. And oftentimes having time in the city and being able to marinate on it gives that team a little bit of an advantage in that sense. Except, if the Sox were in a situation where they're at a stalemate with Philly and they could up their offer by $20-30 million and actually, capitalize on it, they should do it. Whether or not, that's a viable strategy for Rick Hahn and the ownership would get behind that, that's a whole other question. But they've put themselves in this situation. They're clearly making themselves into the high bidder kind of sense. They clearly put themselves in this high bidder mentality. I just don't see why you wouldn't, put 2 feet in and jump into the pool rather than, trying to play chicken with the Phillies.
Yeah, and if anybody, I mean, the Phillies, if they're still in on Harper, there's like, if they're willing to go, and the Phillies traditionally have spent a lot more money than the White Sox have. And if Harper's other option is to go back to the Nationals, then, I could see you arguing a preference for one player or the other, even just from a baseball perspective. But that would be a really, I would think, meaningful incentive for Philly to prioritize Harper over Machado, even though obviously, like, parentheses, every team should be trying to sign both of these guys, close parentheses. And I advocated for that back in November. That was like the last big analytical piece I wrote for BP Southside, was saying, the stars have aligned in a really bizarre fashion where not only should the White Sox try to sign both of these players, but they can fit them into even their 2011 budget, for instance, pretty comfortably, even after their recent signings. And these guys are of an age that it would sync up with your competitive window in a way mega free agents don't tend to. So the question I posed is sort of, if they don't land one of these guys, which I think you put it really well. You said, "I'm not emotionally prepared for either outcome at this point," which I thought sums it up really well, which I'm not. But I'm just trying to figure out what the team does with its money. Even if they were going to spend to where they were, like I said, the $120-130 million range, which they should be higher than that given how revenues have changed, exploded around the league. But even so, if they're going to spend back up to that level, what where are they adding that salary in a way that's going to help you in the same way that even quote overpaying for Machado would accomplish? That's I'm trying to figure out
I mean, you could go sign like AJ Pollock, but I just don't understand a willingness to like say, invest say $80 million in AJ Pollock when you wouldn't invest, an extra 20 in Machado. It's one of those things where like that extra dollar or two, in this sense, it becomes a drop in a bucket once you get to $200 million. It every incremental increase that could say linchpin this and end it and put Machado amongst Ricky's boys. To me, like it would just be completely unacceptable if they didn't come away with one of them. It just outright unacceptable. They've put themselves in the situation. You have to get one of them. There's because what else? Like you said, what else are you gonna do? You could, like I said, you can go sign AJ Pollock, or you can go bail the Cubs out of Jason Hayward's deal for whatever scrap you might get from them. Maybe you get Ian Happ if you're somehow lucky enough to negotiate your way into that or something like that. But this is just too good of an opportunity, and you can't sit here and say I'm going to wait for Nolan Arenado next offseason. Like I love Nolan Arenado. I would gladly give him all the money he wants to get. I don't care that he's going to be 29 or whatever. But like the likelihood that he hits the market is unknown, and I would say it's probably unlikely. And you could say the same about just as many other free agents next offseason, 2 offseasons, 3 offseasons from now. You have the opportunity sitting right in front of you right now, and you might as well jump on it.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because that's the other argument as well. You wait for the next guy to come available next offseason or the year after, but that just feels like this eternal, this like Sisyphean carrot being dangled on a fishing line ahead of you, and it just keeps being held out just beyond your reach because there's always going to be some one big free agent coming free, and you never. Well, maybe in Arenado's case, like you said, maybe he extends, or maybe they decline. There were so many free agents this offseason who were supposed to be there who are now either less desirable or frankly unavailable. Kershaw and Blackman were supposed to be a part of this class that everyone was saving for, and obviously now they're not. So I don't think you can count on that, and I don't think you can count on the Yankees and Dodgers and Red Sox keeping their powder dry and Cubs in future offseasons. You can't count on Ryu eating up their last space under the luxury tax for the Dodgers every year. So, if that's what's going on there. So yeah, it seems like between that and like Chris Sale winning the World Series for the Red Sox, like I just don't see how you can keep selling fans on waiting for some indefinite time in the future when they haven't made the playoffs in a decade already. And even if you do sign the Pollock types or the an Adam Jones to play right field, or I mean, don't get me wrong, like those guys would improve the team, and this team could get a lot better just by signing solid players at positions that they were really bad last year, like starting pitcher in the outfield is or the main culprits. But this is a team where if Machado and Anderson don't get appreciably better, and if Eloy is quote only, an above average corner outfielder, then I don't know where the impact players are coming from, unless you're really
I
trying
mean,
to string together like an Oakland thing where you just have like, a dozen dudes who are all pretty good plus Matt Chapman, and even then you have the star there, so.
yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, if they hadn't even put themselves in the situation, like I would entirely have advocated for signing guys, like you said, and inviting variance to this team, because right now we sit at this point in baseball where you have, a few teams who are fully in and a bunch of teams who are fully in the tank mode, and those teams who are quote unquote trying to accept a bit of variance onto their roster, and saying, yeah, we'll try to win 80 games and see if it goes any better. Like, has worked out pretty well for, say, like the Twins 2 years ago and stuff like that. And certainly with the way Cleveland's looking, where they're trying to 83 win their way to the division title, like, yeah, like that'd have been great. I would have been very happy with that, and I could have been fully on board. But like I said, they've put themselves in the situation and they have to come away with something. Otherwise, it's disappointing. And, you know, they could come away with nothing and win 85 games and win the division and we'd all be happy. But at the same time, you'd also look back and say, well, if they would have had Machado, maybe they would have won 90 or something and maybe put themselves in a good position in the playoffs. There's always these what ifs. And especially, too, after having a core, in my opinion, when they had Sale and Quintana and all that, they had a core that they should have capitalized on a playoff berth with. And, you know, they fumbled and bumbled their way through the Adam Dunns and the Adam LaRoches and found their way to eternal nothingness.
the Jerry Sands of the world. I feel bad. It's not Jerry Sands' fault. But, yeah, you wind up – and I've tweeted about this too, where, like, on the one hand, this – competitive environment or this marketplace would have been ideal for that 2015-2016 teams, because like that team could have scooped up CJ Krohn for $3 million and signed, you know, traded for Ivan Nova and signed Lance Lynn, and that like would have done really, that would have been a huge boost to that 2016 team, for example. But, you know, even so, like you said, that was a huge mistake or missed opportunity, and now you have multiple rebuild cycles that didn't even, that got 1 year above 500 since 2010, which is a long time now. And I mean, I guess, all right, so this is a sort of a more fun, a less dour way of looking at it, less like life and death with it, but from a stats side, do you, if you could pick just one, would you pick Harper or Machado? Because I've seen this argued, and I could be persuaded either way, I think.
Yeah, I don't really have a preference. It's, I mean, I guess if you put Machado at third base and told me he's going to play third base for the next 6 or 7 years, I'd probably lean Machado.
Yeah, me too. I think I prefer his defense. There's so much more than short. But
yeah, I don't think it's that bad at short that it's been advertised as, partly because a lot of, you know, publicly available metrics are kind of at the whim of positioning. And I don't think it, you see like a pretty big shift when he moved to LA. And I think that's probably closer to where his true kind of talent at shortstop lies. But
like,
I think
10%
it's
below average or whatever at short.
Yeah, it's like, okay, fine. He's a little bit below average. At short, I could deal with that. He'll get older. He's a thick boy. You know, like he'll end up settling in a third after a few years if he really wanted to play shortstop. But if you told me he's going to, from the get-go to the end, play third base, I'd probably take Machado. But that high-level Bryce Harper that we saw, you know, once when he was, you know, at that kind of what everyone thinks Bryce Harper level, you know, it's hard to avoid. And he's another guy who I don't think is really descriptive. His defensive stats are really descriptive of his talent level at that point. Yeah, I mean, either is fine. I'm not going to argue with anyone.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. If they sign Machado and they make him the shortstop, I'm not going to complain. I mean, I'll probably comment on how I think it'd be more optimal to put him at third, but like, that would still be the most excited I've been about the White Sox in like an extremely long time. And it would signal a really positive change as an organization. But, you know, I preferred Harper's skill set for a long time in terms of, I feel like walks and that kind of power are more stable than, I mean, because, you know, Machado's 2017 was quite poor. You know, Harper's got 20 points of DRC on them for their careers. You know, that said, you know, with our new DRC plus stat, I mean, I didn't think I knew that Machado had a career year offensively last year, but I didn't really appreciate just how good it was, because he had a, you know, mid 140s DRC plus last year, which is, you know, wait, that's up in the sort of wheelhouse of Harper's better years. So other than his, you know, his Ted Williams season notwithstanding. So yeah. I mean, I'd be thrilled with both, but I was curious if you had like a strong preference, because some people Some people really do. So, that being said, I mean, do you see any, well, first of all, I guess there's the should and do you think different questions. Like, what would you do and what do you think the team is going to do? If they whiff on both of them, other on the position side, I mean, do you see any value to signing someone like Keuchel to, say, the Arrieta contract, or do you see any other moves that you're, like, hoping as a White Sox fan that they'll do?
I mean, Keuchel is a tough one just because I think he'll probably get a little overpaid. But at the same time, too, I think he kind of is what he is now, probably for that contract. So maybe it's still worth it, especially with way the players have been valued over this offseason. You know, that might be something worth kind of getting after and taking advantage of. But, you know, I mean, like I said before, you know, if this wasn't the situation they were in, I would love them to go after some guys like that and fill out the roster with, you know, some veterans who can provide kind of a known quantity. Like, if they strike out on both and they sign Moustakas, I'm on board. I like that signing. He was very good last year for the Brewers and the Mariners, and I think he was like a 3-win player or something last year. Yeah, 3.7 win player. His DRC plus was just over, just around 110. You know, 109 with KC and 113 with Milwaukee. I think he's fine. I think he's a little you know, aggressively shit on by some White Sox fans on Twitter right now. Just because, like I said, we're talking about Manny Machado, and then you move to Mike Moustakas, and I understand that. That's completely fair. But yeah, I think there's definitely opportunities for them to improve kind of steadily. If they don't, it's just separating yourself from the where we were to where we are now kind of situation that might, you know, bring in that kind of trepidation.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say they back themselves into a corner where they, you know, have to get one of these guys, and I sincerely think that's true. But, you know, then again, like, you still have, you know, so much of the fan base, baseball generally, and the White Sox in particular, have been persuaded that the cheaper team is always better no matter what, and have defended, you know, for I've gotten into arguments with people about how the White Sox have never really made a meaningful offer to a major free agent, you know, talking above $100 million. And people have even cited their Tanaka bid as a sign that they're really serious actors in free agency. And that was a blind bid. It was, you know, a player coming from Japan. So it's a posting system. It's not technically a normal free agent. But, I mean, they still got beat by, well, like $70-80 million on that bid.
Is that even a serious offer? That's always my, if somebody brought that up to me, I'm like, that's not even, you're not even in the ballpark.
Yeah. I mean, if you got Tanaka for $100 million, it's still like a windfall. Like, that's not you really putting yourself out there. And if, that was the joke where I was like, you know, I've offered $200,000 for a townhouse in Gramercy Park. It's like, yeah, that's the most money I've offered for anything ever, but that would buy maybe like the front hallway of a town hall in Gramercy Park. So it's not really an offer. And I'm really worried about, you know, just from the fan angle, like, how much I can continue to engage with the team if it turns out that, say, he signs for Machado and, you know, Harper sign elsewhere for like $240 million and the White Sox weren't willing to go there. You know, they offered 7-10 or something. And yeah, Everyone will say, oh, wow, look, they offered 7-10. That's really huge. But, you know, it's wasn't enough to get it done. And I don't know what else they use that money for. So, it's, I've gotten myself way too invested now, which is a problem. I don't know what you make of the rest of the roster at this point. Eloy and John Jay, would somehow still represent like a pretty significant upgrade in the outfield, as modest as a player as John Jay is. Alonso could be a pretty, you know, solid upgrade over, I don't want to hurt everyone's feelings, over Daniel Palco, over Matt Davidson, over Nicky Delmonico, those types.
I mean, as a Daniel Palco owner in fantasy baseball, I am deeply offended.
I mean, I want, like, if Palco could get his on base over 300, like, I'm for it. I wish teams would go back to, I mean, I'm already there. I guess this is me being old now. The style of baseball from when I was a kid, where you had like 10 pitchers on your roster instead of like 18. And then Palco would absolutely have like an amazing roster spot. He would get, you know, 350, 400 plate appearances a year only against righties, and he would hit like 25, 30 homers, and it would be great. But it's harder to fit now. So,
and that I guess brings me to something that I guess a little off topic, but it's something I like to see them do. Which is acquire more multi-positional guys, mm-hmm. which I don't think they have enough of. They have Yolmer, and I love Yolmer. I love him to death, but that's it.
Oh, yeah. you're sleeping on Lurie.
Oh yeah. See, I forgot about Lurie. Okay, Lurie too. But we'll see coming into next year if Lurie can repeat his brilliance.
He just can't stay healthy at this point, it seems, which is, you know, he's coming off of 2 years as like a really nice bench player. But he's played 80 games each of the last couple of years. So, I along those lines, like Jed Lowrie just signed with the Mets for 2 years, $20 million. And like, that's the type of dude you might've been talking about, although he might've, you know, he would have commanded a everyday starting spot, and I don't know if you would rotate him through like right field or anything.
Yeah,
like
I mean that's kind of what I'm getting at is it allows you to kind of cascade those platoons throughout your lineup, and you're giving yourself an option to, you know, maybe you have a couple of right hand platoon guys that can see, you know, a few hundred at bats rather than, you know, straight up platooning a right fielder who against righties and a right fielder against lefties. Maybe that's, you know, I don't know, that like how the Royals use Whit Merrifield, how the Cubs use Happ and Zobrist, and it allows them to kind of mix match for different situations and kind of maximize each of the roster spots. And it allows you to go deeper into your bench and say one of two spots for guys who play a significant amount of time and getting them the most kind of exposure to, you know, regular pitching and, you know, getting regular at-bats. I think that's something that will go a long way on this roster, especially as it gets younger and guys need more at-bats, guys need more opportunities to see the field. It really kind of gives you a good amount of player development opportunities throughout your minor league system as well, if you can kind of cascade that, you know, philosophy, you know, from the majors down to, you know, your DSL teams.
Yeah, I mean, Marwin Gonzalez is obviously like an extreme example of, you know, positional flexibility, and he's still out there, you know, switch hitter.
He'd be perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a lot of sense. And I mean, frankly, given the White Sox situation, you know, you don't want to pencil, you don't want to lock in anybody in any position because stuff happens. But, you know, you have a situation where you have Anderson and Mankata up the middle, and third base isn't clear at this point, I would say. And then you have Nick Madrigal coming. And, you know, if you do sign a Moustakas or you do sign a Machado even, there's might be a lot of shuffling, and one of those guys might wind up in center. You don't really know. I mean, you only really have a half season and a bunch of flashes and tools from Anderson. I mean, I think Anderson is, if he just does what he did the second half of last year, he's just a plus defensive shortstop. And I think Moncada should be perfectly solid at second. But you might be in a position where you're needing to move guys around and try things out. And if you just have Marwin Gonzalez to backfill wherever you slide somebody, it makes things a lot easier, and you know, people get hurt, and just having literally a switch hitter who can play every position. It's like if Lory Garcia had power. So
yeah,
I mean, he'd be a great fit. And I think you could still, I mean, it's crazy because they lost 100 games last year. I still think you could wind up with a team that at least is playing, isn't like mathematically eliminated in August and September next year. If you made some modest signings like Marvin Gonzalez, or, you know, added another depth starting pitcher in case Giolito is just needs to be moved to the pen or something like that. So I still think it's there. I'll be, if they don't get Machado or Harper, I'm going to need some me time to like heal, but but it's still out there, in my opinion. I mean, Grandal signing for 1 year.
Like, that one hurt.
I went to sleep like depressed when I saw that.
He's just so good, and I understand that. I don't think a lot of pitchers love throwing to him. But why would we at all defer to this pitching staff and what they like, don't like? Like, just sign the guy. He will make all of them better. And if they want to bitch about it, fine. Have fun, Dylan Covey. Like, seriously, your ERA is under five now. This is a career year for you. No, just bought yourself another year in baseball.
Like, I wonder. I legitimately would, because he signed for like 18 and a half is like a good, you know, the value of the 1 year is not necessarily like setting off alarm bells for me. It's just the fact that it was a 1 year deal. Like, I wonder if he just couldn't get a 2019 salary higher than that. And he was just like, you know what, screw it. I'll take the highest salary for 2019. I'll go play for a team that won 90 something games, was in the NLCS last year. And, you know, I'll come back next winter and maybe be no worse off. You know, maybe if a team was offering him $345, he's like, well, you know, I'll take more money next year and come back without the comp pick attached. Maybe that's all that happened. I still think it's crazy that, like, because if you just signed, like, so much of Grandal's value is in his glove, but, like, Carlos Santana got $360 last year, and Grandal's bat is, like, probably better than Santana's, just, like, straight up or, like, close to it.
The only thing is, I think that happened before kind of, you know, the dark days had started. I think the Phillies weren't quite in on the whole
they weren't on the email chain.
They might have got the memo like a little late. I might have went to their spam filter or something. I don't know.
Yeah, they were doing normal baseball.
Yeah, Matt Klentak has finds a way to zig when everyone's zagging, and then it's not always the best zag.
I mean, like, even so, it's funny because, like, you know, everyone's like, oh man, the Phillies were the ones like signing these guys and paying all this money, but like, they still wound up 80-82, which is their best season in like years, and would be the best White Sox season in years. And it's not like they, you know, saddled themselves with all these albatrosses that they can't manage anymore. And like, a lot of it, like, Santana didn't have a great year, but a lot of the problem was just that they already had Reese Hoskins, and Reese Hoskins couldn't play left. If Reese Hoskins could have played left, then maybe they don't even, maybe they're just like, everybody's like, yeah, that was a good signing. So even
goes, that goes to what I was saying before, just invite variance into your outcome. Maybe you'll win 80 games and maybe that's fine, but at least you're getting the opportunity to see something play out.
Also, you know, having watched 80 something win teams, 70 something win teams, and now 60 something win teams, anybody says there's no point in winning 75 games for 63 games doesn't watch the games. Cause it is miserable watching a 100 loss season. I've watched 70 something win teams and been like, you know what? I had some fun out of that, but like, oh my God, it was a death march. Do you like looking at what they have on hand now? I mean, you're talking about variance, like just looking at, I look at the rotation, I'm like, this could be like a sneaky solid rotation next year, or this could be like an absolute disaster. I don't know how you, like, just taking it a piece at a time, like this rotation group, like Rodon, Ronaldo Lopez, Nova, Giolito, and then some mix of apparently Covey, Medeiros, Stevens, maybe Dylan Cease later on. Like, what? I'm going to give you a talk about the rotation.
Well, I think it's bad.
DRA hates those guys. DRA
yeah, it really does, and I don't disagree with it. like Reynaldo Lopez, I think he kind of sucks, but maybe he could be good in the bullpen, and maybe he proves me wrong this year. Giolito was okay at the end of the year. He got better, obviously, but like he was awful at the beginning of the year. Like, I think I went to see like 3 of his starts at the beginning of the year, and I think he gave up like 10 runs every time. You know, easily be overstating this, but I don't think anyone would be like, oh man, I think he's definitely wrong. I'm going to go check Baseball Reference to see, you know,
yeah.
Like everyone
yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Whether or not it's right or not, it sounds right. That's a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, I only went to see him live once. It was in 2017, and he threw 7 innings, 1 run a ball against the Royals. So, and maybe I just need to, the White Sox need to hire me to watch every game he pitches in live. But
I mean, I saw Matt Latos win 4 games 1 year. I mean,
all right. I mean, like,
crazy things happen at the ballpark sometimes.
Yeah. Like, moving forward, I mean, Lopez is so weird too, because like, obviously his run prevention was good. He holds his velocity well. He flashes 2 different plot, like every now and then, like his breaking pitch looks really good and his changeup looks really good. You just have no idea whether they're actually going to show up on a given day. And his command is obviously a work in progress. And then you hear stories like, I can't get past, like, there was that game at Yankee, I think it was at Yankee Stadium, where he was throwing like 90, and then it came out after the, and he still like muddled through the game pretty well, and he learned from it. But one of the things that came out, he was like, he forgot to stretch before the game, which is like, you hear that and you're like, well, that's easy to fix. You know, like, that's like, hey dude, you pitch like once a week, like circle that day on your calendar and stretch that day. But so like, if there's stuff like that, then theoretically there's like room for him to improve his routine and get his mechanics smoothed out or whatever he needs to do. Like, and maybe it's just because he had the shiniest ERA coming off of last year, but like, I still hold some hope that he can hold it down as like a number 4 starter. But like, do you have more confidence in him or Giolito?
I mean, I like Ronaldo Lopez's stuff, but it's one of those things where like, I've kind of been on the side that, you know, they should have let go of Cooper and went a different direction with the pitching coach as well. And I think that maybe he's playing into the clutches with Ronaldo Lopez too. But at the same time, it's these are 2 talented guys. I think Giolito is less talented than Lopez, and they're both not performing. I'm willing to give Lopez more than enough, you know, chances. And with, obviously, like you said, he's got the stuff. The command's got to get there, and I guess he's got to get his head in the game. But Giolito is a tough nut to crack. Is that end of the last year worth holding on to hope for, or should we be looking, you know, elsewhere for that spot?
He threw 50 innings in 2017, where his DRA, you know, liked him just fine. So I guess it's just that, you know, he's a big dude. He's a cerebral guy. He's always, you know, tweaking his delivery, his pitch mix. He has a different set of pitches that are, some pitches are working some days, some aren't. His velocity's all over the place, start to start and inning to inning. And I just, you know, like, I don't know how you figure out. I mean, the White Sox have to run him out there, but like, I don't, as an analyst, if fans are like, what do you expect from him? I just, like, I have no idea. I guess the safest bet is to say he'll probably be bad. But, yeah, I didn't know if you felt any particular compunction one way or the other.
I guess mine would just be, I would just like a new pitching coach and see what happens. You know, like I have a lot of Cooper fatigue, and I'm just tired of seeing guys throw shitty cutters.
I mean, the league has certainly moved away from cutters, certainly from when Cooper was like at his peak in terms of results. But like, there are, you know, there are other guys in the organization who are well regarded in terms of, like, Richard Dotson is supposed to be good. Matt Zaleski, I think, is the coach that they've been sort of pairing with Alec Hansen.
Yep.
And so there's other guys that they've been, you know, obviously have learned under Cooper and probably have their own ideas. So maybe that's something that needs to happen. I actually hadn't thought about it. I just kind of, you know, Cooper had in my head organized as, it's like, well, this isn't the problem with the organization, but I don't know, maybe they need to, you know, Matt Trueblood's written so much about how much the league as a whole has changed their pitch mix. And obviously everyone's read a lot about how hitters are changing their swings, and, you know, it's all fastball slider now instead of cutter sinker stuff. So,
yeah. And the kind of one solution pitching coach has kind of gone by the wayside. The Dave Duncans and the Don Coopers don't really exist as much anymore. And, you know, the teams with the best kind of pitching development systems, you know, they don't have a one size fits all kind of mentality. They have a system that engenders growth across the entire organization and kind of, you know, lets guys like Houston, for example, I would say would probably have the best, you know, pitching development program, and their entire system that genders kind of guys like Josh James to just pop up.
Yeah.
You know, that they this is something that happens in those organizations, and I don't think the Sox are there, and I don't think that's something that they could really be condemned for. You know, Houston's done a lot of really groundbreaking things. But, you know, you don't see that kind of, and I think it might be a little reductive to call Cooper a one solution type guy, but I think he would maybe be more suited to, you know, a front office role where he could, you know, delegate what he knows about pitching more towards what Rick Hahn's doing rather than, you know, more towards what Lucas Giolito and Reynaldo Lopez are doing on an everyday basis. Because, you know, the pitching development and pitching coaching is a pretty rapidly changing field right now. It has been over the past few years, and it's just, yeah, it seems like an easy way for the Sox to at least try something different as an organization who, you know, over the past X many years has really been adverse to change.
Yeah. I mean, they bet hard on Carson Fulmer, who's the type of guy where, you know, 10 years ago you would say, oh yeah, like this guy throws cutters and he's short and has a weird delivery, and the White Sox are really good at getting those guys to perform up. And obviously, like, he can't even succeed as a starter in AAA. So, like, that was a top 10 pick gone. You know, even so, you know, obviously for all that they've given, Houston's given Verlander new lease on life, and Gerrit Cole finally seems to have hit the potential that he hadn't quite hit in Pittsburgh. And you get Charlie Morton velocity bumps, and you get, you know, for all these great developments, I mean, they have their share of busts too. I mean, like, and maybe bust is too hard for Francis Martes, for example, but, you know, Martes was as roughly in the same prospect tier as, you know, Ronaldo Lopez and Giolito post Tommy John. So, and he's may not be able to put it together. And, you know, the David Paulino isn't really, so, you know, it's sometimes it's just, it was never going to work out, even,
yeah,
you know, with the Astros.
I mean, I think for Houston, it's more or less that whole system is kind of put in a position to succeed. So if a couple of guys bust, you know, you have guys like Josh James who just kind of
come
rise to the occasion. Yeah, they come out of nowhere.
We need to check all of our pitchers for sleep apnea is the answer. Every last one. That's the lesson of Moneyball. Let's check your pitchers for sleep apnea. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not the last guy in the Machado bandwagon, am I? Or not Machado. Sorry, Moncada. I'm doing that now.
Oh, that's clearly, no, I'm on the yo-yo bandwagon. Let's go, yo-yo. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's solid now. I think there's more in there, but I.
He's got the talent. Like, it's very obvious. It's just like the put it to, he needs to put it together. And I feel like I sound like a every guy, half the guys who call into like the score or whatever, who are, you know, screaming at the other half of the guys who are calling into the score saying the different thing. But if he doesn't strike out at 35% of the time or whatever it was, and he strikes out 30% of the time, which I think is a reasonable goal for him. It's something that Javier Baez managed to do. You know, he's a good player. And if he does a little bit less than that, then he's an even better player. It's, you know, the changes he has to make to chip away at that, I don't think are necessarily going to be as hard as it would be for, you know, a guy who's striking out at 20% of the time, who's struggling, because it just more or less, I think for him, it's a little, it just, I think he needs to be a little bit more aggressive early in the count, for one
Yeah.
thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I think he led the league in like striking out looking, which, you know, a lot of them, some of them were out of the zone, some of them were, you know, really close. So I guess it's just a matter of like I think two strike approach in tandem with attacking more before he gets to the two strike position, because it's weird to me to have a guy where he has so much bat speed and he has such a good eye to be striking out that much. That's what's weird to me. It's like he clearly has a really good sense of the zone. He's clearly patient. He's clearly not scared to wait for his pitch. And it's not like he has a slider speed bat. So like I think you put all that together and I'm just thinking like this dude should be hitting at least like 250, 260, surely.
Yeah,
But instead of 220, 230.
and you see it with, you know, a lot of the with basically all the elite hitters and you know, a lot of just guys you would call quote unquote professional hitters is they don't have one swing. It's different. They have different kind of takes of different things, and you know, you the most obvious case is, you know, Anthony Rizzo has that pretty clear two strike approach. Joey Votto has kind of a similar take on it.
Yeah,
And
choking
you know,
up like hard.
And just kind of having a different mindset when you kind of take up that, you know, your spot in the batter's box. But I don't think Moncada has that. I don't think Moncada kind of puts himself in this position to kind of see the at bat differently as each pitch comes along. I think he's a little bit like you said, you know, he's watching those pitches go by. In two strike situations, and you know, he needs to be able to say, you know, I need to make contact here, and I need to put myself in a position to, you know, draw more pitches here. He like you said, he clearly has a good eye. He clearly is a patient hitter, but there's, you know, too patient. That's Kyle Schwarber is a good analogy here because he was in the same situation, though not quite the same stats. He was in a similar situation when he had his down year. When he was kind of putting himself down in the count and he was getting making bad contact, et cetera, et cetera. He took it into the next year and kind of took that approach upon himself, and he improves pretty drastically compared to the year before. I think it's very easy, like I said, it's very easy for Moncada to kind of chip away at the top end where he's, you know, pretty poor at, and then making those. Once again, incremental, you know, kind of steps forward is going to be challenging after that. But if he cuts off a few percentage points on his strikeout rate, he's a good player.
Yeah, and a guy who it, that you know when you actually got me thinking about other players who kind of done this, someone who I hope it doesn't take this long for Moncada, but like Aaron Hicks is someone who comes to mind where you know Hicks was a tool monster first round draft pick himself, and he was a big prospect. I mean, he was not to the Moncada level, but like you know he was a first round draft candidate as an outfielder and as a pitcher, and people loved. They were like, oh, he's got a great eye. He's got a great eye. He walks like crazy in the minors. And it turned out it was like, well, he's really passive. Like he just puts his bat on his shoulder and lets minor league pitchers walk him. And then he gets to the majors and they just attack him and he didn't know how to handle it. And, you know, it felt like it took forever, but, you know, he broke out in his age 27 season. Unfortunately for the Twins, it was in another organization, but he's now got 2 years where Hicks has been one of the best, you know, center fielders in the league. And so it's possible to do it. And it's an unusual problem. It's unusual to have to tell young hitters, hey, swing more. Hey, like, swing first pitch more. Hey, expand the zone on two strikes a little more. Like, that's so backwards, but that may be, you know, everyone's different. Like, development's so strange.
It's not linear. Everyone expects it to be linear. It is not.
Do you, I guess before we wrap, do you have any, like, pet, like, small signings you want them to make? Like, not the big dudes, but, like, is there, like, a random, like, starting pitcher out there on, like, a minor league deal? Like, is there a dude that you just were like, this would be a great idea?
Chris Wolstad. Mean...
Nah, he's replacing Cooper as pitching coach.
Why didn't I think of that? Jeez.
Not to, like, put you on the spot. I'm like, I guess Moustakas, you floated earlier, is kind of a that type of guy. I mean, I think... Obviously, if they don't sign Machado, this is like you wouldn't. If you sign Machado, then Yolmer Sanchez is your fifth infielder, and you're good. I think, but Lowry was the guy. Obviously, he's now in New York. I like Derek Dietrich. Is that weird?
I don't think that's weird.
Derek Dietrich is
oddly enough
for me. I kind of like Yonjervis Solarte.
Oh, I do like him. That would be a good one.
Oh, okay,
that's a good one.
I don't mean to steal your ask you a question then steal the good answers, but
like skimming through the free agent list, like
yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, nobody like blows off the top of my head. DJ LeMahieu, I think, is underrated.
I do too. DRC Plus loves him.
Yeah, I've been the like Colorado doesn't deserve this park effect guy for a while in the Slack, and then, you know, Judge goes out and makes a stat that says that, so I feel very vindicated.
That was nice of him to do that for you.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate his work. John Jay honestly would have probably been my answer before they signed him, and they signed him, so I'm very happy about that.
That's great.
You know, there are other guys out there. You know, I mean, like, you want to throw a bone at Josh Harrison and say maybe, you know, he could be one of those kind of bench, Swiss Army knife kind of guys. You know, I'd buy into that.
Do you like for arms? Do you like any of like Chris Tillman, Irvin Santana, Joe Gonzalez, any of these, Marco Estrada, and is any of these do anything for you?
Well, the first two, I mean, maybe a little sick to my stomach, but
Tillman would be entirely betting on a post Orioles bump,
which is honestly not bad science, I don't think.
that's my analytics right there.
If you get Gio on the cheap, I wouldn't mind it. He's not bad at all. Like, he's scary in the playoffs. I wouldn't give him more than, you know, I wouldn't give him a start in the playoffs and say, hey, you know, I'm gonna trust my intestinal fortitude to Gio Gonzalez, but I'm also not really thinking about the playoffs right now.
No, if the White Sox are picking playoff starters, it's like that'd be the best problem they've had since the Bush administration.
I guess one more, maybe, like, you know, Brad Brock. He's a pretty good history of just being a really solid kind of middle reliever.
I mean,
the bullpen, I think, is generally pretty fine. But
yeah,
guys like that, if it doesn't work out, they're worth a little bit. You know, you get like a comp pick or something for him at the deadline, or, you know, maybe a guy you can kind of bet on that your scouts like. That could be interesting. So in the same vein of the Kelvin Herrera signing, he's a little bit lower ticket buy there, but, you know, at the same time, it's in the same kind of vein and the same kind of, you know, thought process going forward.
Yeah, you can always use more relievers, and you can always trade them.
Exactly.
Anthony, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, I had a great time.
Hopefully, I mean, we'd love to have you back. And we have a bigger pool of regular White Sox dudes to draw on if you want to chat more Southside with us in the future. But in the meantime, where can people check out your work or your baseball thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, whenever I do a research project, it's published on the main site. I published the draft value calculator last year with Martin Alonso, and I have some work that I'm planning on doing this year on that, along with a couple other projects that I kind of have on the wire. You know, as with the nature of the R&D team, you know, we kind of take our time with these things. So, you know, might come out tomorrow, might come out, you know, at the end of the year, who knows. But that's where you'll find me.
And is a great follow on Twitter, Anthony Reskin, spelled Anthony Rescan, but not pronounced that way, on Twitter.
All memes, just all memes.
Big Chungus Twitter account right there. Anthony, thanks again. And hey, enjoy the movies.
Cheers. Have a good one, man.
You too.